This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello, welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. Today I'm interviewing Edmund Shanuga-Bark, Professor of Developmental Psychology, Psychiatry and Neuroscience at King's College London and Editor-in-Chief of the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry. The focus of today's podcast will be Edmund's recent editorial in the July 2021 issue of the JCPP, No Pain, No Gain, Towards the Inclusion of Mental Health Costs in Balanced Lockdown Decision-Making During Health Pandemics. If you're a fan of our In Conversation series, please subscribe on iTunes or your preferred streaming platform. Let us know how we did with the rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues. Hi, Edmund. Thanks for joining me. Can you start by introducing yourself?
Well, I think you did a very good job. I'm a professor in the Department of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, and I have been editor-in-chief of the journal, I think now it's my 11th year for my sins.
And we're going to focus on the latest editorial in the JCPP, which is No Pain, No Gain, Towards the Inclusion of Mental Health Costs in Balanced Lockdown Decision-Making During Health Pandemics. Edmund, what was the purpose of this editorial?
So I really wrote it to get a discussion going about what I think is one of the most critical questions for our field at this time, just about in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. Mm-hmm. And it's a question that my colleagues, I think, or the field in general, have been very reticent to get involved with. And so I thought, I think it could do a service for the field to raise it and hope that I get some reactions and responses and get people talking about this question. And the question is, of course, what place should mental health costs take or play in the evaluation of public health interventions such as lockdown? It's kind of surprising people haven't been discussing this. It seems something that's really obvious to everybody, but nobody's talking about it. And that's particularly because, of course, at the start of the pandemic, quite serious impacts on mental health and, of course, on quality of life more generally were anticipated by everybody, including, of course, the policymakers and the governments and so forth. So that's one reason we should be talking about it. The second reason is that anybody who's involved in the evaluation of interventions realizes that the scientific approach to doing that involves taking account of estimates of not only the benefits of the intervention, but also its costs. We're told that it is good practice, and it clearly is self-evidently good practice, to employ a sort of a cost-benefit approach to saying whether an intervention works or not. So I think that's the key question here. And I guess we can break that down into three bits, which I've kind of tried to do in the editorial. Mm-hmm. And the first bit really is there a reason why this sort of recommended approach shouldn't apply to lockdown?
Okay.
And I've racked my brains and I honestly can't think of a reason why it shouldn't apply to lockdown as an intervention. We should look at the benefits and the costs of lockdown. Part 2A is, why is nobody proposing that as an approach, even at this marginal point where the benefits are obviously much lower than they were at the peak of the spread of infection? It seems such an obvious question for us to be asking. So what are the barriers? What's stopping people asking that question? What are the principal barriers? You know, are the principal reasons we shouldn't be asking that question, or are there more pragmatic reasons to do with political expedience and so forth? And then finally, of course, and this is what I wrote about in the editorial, is there a sort of a path to addressing those barriers so that we can have a sort of roadmap for future decisions about lockdown? Because I sense that this won't be the last time that this will be implemented. whether it's to do with highly infectious disease like COVID, whether people are even talking about it in terms of climate change and all sorts of things now. So we need a model whereby we can figure out if the benefits outweigh the costs of this sort of intervention.
We'll explore that in today's podcast. I just want to pick up on something you said. You mentioned that also your colleagues have been reticent to explore
this. Yeah. Whenever I discuss it, because I think it's such a crucial question, I probably discuss it too often. There's a sort of embarrassed silence in the room as people look at their feet, you know. So I think there's somehow the notion that even if you raise it, somehow you're letting the side down and risking undermining the message about the benefits of lockdown. And I've written about this in another editorial, actually, but I think that that's had a stifling effect on scientific debate within the field. And of course, again, this is really about the nature of science. I suppose we're talking now rather than any particular recommendation about whether or not we should lock down under what circumstances. I'm not commenting on that at all. But, you know, what science requires is that we have a discussion about those things. We raise alternative positions and hypotheses, and we try as best we can to test them. That is science. And we're constantly told to follow the science, but not in a serious way, for fear that you undermine public confidence in government policy. So there's this fascinating tension between the need to get people to follow policy and not to undermine their confidence, but on the other hand, to allow discussion and debate, which is completely normal and natural within the scientific community.
And I'm going to return specifically to the editorial. And when you're talking about costs in the editorial, you're really talking about the cost to families' mental health.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, that's what I got my some degree of expertise in. That I've been working in the field 35 years. So I've got some expertise in that question. Other costs, of course, of lockdown relate to kind of broader aspects of quality of life. In terms of the obviously self-evident ones, in terms of restricting normal daily activities without hindrance, which is a definition of normal quality of life. And of course, also civil liberties. So those are other aspects and other costs, but I don't really have much expertise in those.
Yeah. You talked about the barriers that stopped governments focusing on the costs as well as the benefits. So what were the barriers that stopped governments from setting the benefits of lockdown against mental health costs?
As I say in the editorial, I think there are three that I want to focus on. And there are obviously others. And I've really not gone into the rabbit hole of motives at all. And that, you know, that takes people down in some strange places. So it's not about motives. It's not about the kind of sociology of science or anything. It's about taking the decision not to consider these costs at face value. And so I argue that there are three basic constraints in the editorial. The first is we haven't yet provided strong enough evidence that lockdown plays a causal role in negative impacts on mental health. And by that, I mean we need to go further than the correlational studies that are being carried out. So people are showing that, for instance, in the UK, that the study, co-space study by Professor Cresswell in Oxford, has shown there's been a deterioration in certain aspects of mental health during the periods of lockdown. But of course, that's really correlational. And we need to somehow move further towards isolating that more causal relationship between the lockdown experience and mental health effects. And I benefited from working with Professor Sir Michael Rutter, I think for 15 years on the English-Romanian adoptee study, which is a so-called natural experiment. And I think there is potential to do natural experiments. Clearly, you can't do fully randomized controlled trials of lockdown. It's neither ethical or politically expedient. So you can't randomize to lockdown and not lockdown, but you can take advantage of chance allocations of lockdown. So you can compare the timing of lockdown in different regions. So we did have a period where there were different levels of lockdown. So if you had the right study, you could compare the impacts of those different degrees of lockdown and the different timings of those lockdowns and start to develop a more precise mapping or matching of the effect and the exposure. So that's what we need to do. We need definitely to, and I think people realize this, it's just, these are just difficult studies to plan and to run. Obviously, particularly, you know, last March when nobody knew what on earth was going on. Maybe we should have planned a few more relatively quickly after that. You know, maybe we needed a more coordinated approach at the government. I mean, they've funded a lot of COVID-related research. We have a study of a parent training intervention designed specifically for COVID-related increases in behavioral problems at home. So they funded loads of research, but maybe it's a little bit fragmented and piecemeal. It could have been more coordinated, identifying really what the key things are we need to focus on. So that's one thing I think that's been a challenge, is to persuade. It all seems a little bit speculative, probably to the planners. But if we can make a stronger inference, let's say, about the causal relationship between this exposure and mental health. I think the other key thing is to recognize that the effects are going to vary enormously by setting. And we knew that probably before it started. We knew that vulnerable individuals, people with pre-existing risks, people in difficult circumstances, particularly kids in fragile families, are going to be at particular risk. Mm. I mean, they're the ones who are not going to sign up to studies, of course. Sometimes it's hard to remember what it was actually like last March. You tend to forget, maybe we were repressing it, but it was very restrictive, wasn't it? And you can imagine, I think it's so great if you've got a lovely garden and a lovely park and you're allowed to go for your one walk a day or whatever it was. But if you're living in a high-rise flat and, you know, three kids in a bedroom or something, which I don't think our policymakers have perhaps bore that in mind as much as they ought, perhaps. I don't know.
In the editorial, I think you used the expression where you talked about the likelihood that lockdown would create a toxic cocktail.
Yeah. Okay. I chose the words carefully because I think from what we know, not about lockdown, but about other circumstances. So one of our interventions was called Families Under Pressure, that we designed specifically to try and give parenting tips to help kind of ease the pressure cooker a little bit. You know, that's a recipe for maltreatment and abuse, you know, particularly for kids who are going to play up a bit more. Maybe they have some underlying vulnerabilities, maybe kids with a little bit of ADHD or autism or whatever are going to play up a bit more when they're under pressure and frustrated. And of course, worried parents are going to react a little bit more. And of course, you get into, you know, this toxic cycle within families where things can escalate out of control and lead to even to maltreatment in situations where that's never been an issue before. So this was a unique set of risk factors. You know, I'm really hoping that we'll get a better insight into those sorts of vulnerable families. So we have seen, for instance, a big increase in calls to the NSPCC helplines during the first and the second lockdowns from children. And there's a big worry, I think, within child services that there's been a significant drop in the number of referrals by social workers because, of course, they weren't going out. They weren't seeing what was happening. So it's been very hard to quantify it. But everything we know about family dynamics and parent-child relations and interactions would say that this is a high-risk situation. And all the initial data suggests that that's the case. So I really think that should be a real focus going forward.
But we'll return to the various steps that you suggest in the editorial can be used to address the various limiting factors. But one of the things you mention in the editorial is that far from governments acting irrationally in mental health costs, you say their one-sided benefit-focused approach to decision-making was inevitable. So why was it inevitable?
I think under the circumstances, we've had a little insight into the pressure under which the government were working from Mr. Cummings' testimony in the last day or two or last week or whenever it was. Nobody really knew what they were doing. And I think the scientific advisors, I think they would be honest enough to say they really didn't know how this was going to behave at that stage. And the models, you know, were certainly limited in many ways that were projecting the numbers. So I think there was a sense of panic. And I think under those circumstances, of course, your attentional focus as a policymaker or a researcher becomes very narrow. Mm-hmm. And so you have one index and one index only, and that is infection, COVID-related illness, and obviously COVID-related death. That's all the focus was on. And that's completely understandable under those circumstances. But the benefits are clear, you know, of lockdown. I mean, again, I guess that has to all come out in the wash in terms of analysis of the benefits. I can't comment on that. That's not my area.
Yeah.
But in terms of the costs, they're much more diffuse. They're much less clear cut. We were speculating at that stage about the costs. Everybody thought there would be costs, apart from the obvious ones like civil liberties. That was actually part and parcel of the actual lockdown. But, you know, in terms of mental health and other quality of life, they were much more obtuse and so much more difficult to implement. I think my concern now is that still nobody's focusing on that question. It's not that it was not expectable under the emergency conditions. It was that it's not been taken into account since we got a clearer handle of what was going on. You know, and clearly there's lots of unknowns still about COVID-19 that we're still trying to get our heads around in terms of lots and lots of questions there, but, you know, which are all fascinating. But, you know, I think what worries me is that people still aren't asking this question about costs and benefits. And that's what I would like to see, an open debate about that. And maybe we can only do it once the whole thing's finished, because at that point, of course, there's no risk of undermining the messaging because the messaging isn't necessary. But we really do need to think of a way or develop some instruments that would allow us to develop a more nuanced modelling.
So you talked about the need to build natural health experiments. And then a second step that you outline is developing health economic models that allow the cost of lockdown to be balanced against its benefits.
Yeah.
You say in ways that are supported by the general public.
I mean, I'm not a health economist. I've obviously, if you evaluate interventions, you get involved with health economics. But it's more at a conceptual level, I think, at this stage. But I think, you know, this is just taken for granted in the evaluation of most interventions, even those where life and death is the issue. So it's not to say this is just about psychiatric interventions. This is about cancer drugs. This is about drugs that extend life expectancy. This is just the norm. It's been surprising that people haven't really started to raise these questions about public health interventions like lockdown. Now, that may be because it's a much more complicated task. As I outline in the editorial, I go through some of the challenges, I think, which kind of take the health economics beyond what it was initially developed for, not in principle, but actually in practice. How would you implement it? And I think one of the most brilliant little concepts that has come along that allows you to balance these things, that is benefits in terms of increasing life expectancy. Say you have a drug, the benefits of that drug might be to increase life expectancy by 5 years. At the same time, it may reduce quality of life by a certain amount. And this notion of quality adjusted life years is a really brilliant concept that allows you to combine those two elements so that one quality adjusted life year, so a value of one, is a whole year lived at full quality of life. And then you kind of go down from that. Lockdown may be an extreme example of that, but in principle, this should apply. This still should be manageable if we can get some of the brains in the health economic field. What's really interesting to me, and I may be wrong on this, I don't think health economists have played a prominent role in the committees that are advising the governments. And I think that may be an interesting point that we need to really set up. We need to really get them involved so that they can bring their expertise to bear. I think, you know, why this is such a challenge, of course, is this is about prevention rather than cure. And so that obviously has some challenges in and of itself. So in a sense, you've got to take into account susceptibility, you know, to a disease rather than having the disease itself. So reducing susceptibility, reducing risk, it's complicated. Secondly, of course, in this case, the actual costs in terms of the intervention, in terms of, say, reduced quality of life, are probably hitting a lot more people, given the kind of selective nature of the process of symptomatic infection, probably hitting a lot more people than the benefits of lockdown. So that's complicated and that's very unusual. You wouldn't find that in a trial, for instance. Another thing that's really important, of course, is the cost and benefit ratio varies so much by demographics. And how do you account for that? So, for instance, young people are very unlikely to die of COVID, we now know, or even to suffer serious health complications from COVID, very unlikely. I don't know the figures, but it's in the 99th centile. On the other hand, of course, they're experiencing a lot of the costs, particularly, you know, there were, at least in the first lockdown, in terms of school.
Yeah.
So this is also very unusual. So clearly there's a lot of work to do. And I do think this is a major barrier. And I think this is an area that we need to really invest in as a community, as a country, as a global community, trying to develop models that would allow us to deal with these complications and extensions of this QALY concept. Because in essence, the QALY concept would say you would only lock down if the QALY gains by locking down were greater, we're talking about the community as a whole, were greater than the QALY losses right. associated with lockdown. Now, that's a really interesting bit of calculus, but we do it all the time. The other point I'm making in the editorial is, of course, we do it all the time in a world full of hazards and risks. We have to do it or we never get out the front door. As I said, you know, there's a, what is it, 1,500 fatalities on the road every year, or something like that. And we could stop all those immediately. We could close all the roads down. But we don't do that. So there is like an implicit QALY calculation going on that. Based, and of course, in a risky and hazardous situation, that's going on all the time at a government level. This would just make it all explicit.
Yeah.
This would kind of try and make this explicit in some way so that we can judge in future at what point does it make sense to implement interventions that are potentially damaging to quality of life and mental health and so forth and so on. Apart from its importance, I just thought it was a wonderfully interesting scientific challenge. Yeah.
Starting to happen, the idea of making these QALY calculations in relation to the impact?
I don't know, you see. I don't know. I haven't seen anything. And I haven't heard anybody, but there are one or two papers that have tried to do some calculations, but they're rather limited. I mean, because of course the costs are very diffuse and trying to estimate the cost, even in a simple trial, is quite a challenge. Mm. So what you do is you try and translate these costs into monetary numbers. That's how they deciding, for instance, whether a drug should be funded on the NHS. This is the sort of analysis that's done. You know, what's the QALY benefit and how much does each QALY cost for this drug? And that's when you get these heart-wrenching stories where there's a very expensive drug and it could be very valuable to a small group of people, but the NHS won't fund it because it isn't cost effective. And so this is obviously a very, very different application to that. But in a sense, the same principles apply. Or if they don't, I'd love somebody to explain to me why they don't. This podcast and this editorial and the talks are kind of a plea to somebody to educate me as to why this shouldn't apply to something like lockdown. I'm very open to being educated. But I think the other thing that's really important that you said is that whatever what they call in economics, the indifference point is, you know, where that QALY gains, QALY losses indifference point is set, there needs to be a discussion within communities about that. Because that indifference point needs to chime with the cultural group within which you're working, and different cultural groups may set that very differently. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, some cultural groups might set one additional year of, say, an 85-year-old person with dementia at a much higher level than another cultural group. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, it sounds awful to give it that concrete nature, but that's exactly the sorts of calculations that would have to go on. And maybe that's not palatable to some cultures, although it's implicit in all cultures. It's always, but those decisions are always being made in a sense. It's kind of, I guess what we need is an honest debate, an honest and open debate about these sorts of really challenging issues. And also the nature of our mortality. It's almost like nobody dies sometimes when you're listening to people. You know, death is an integral part of life. So it's not really about saving lives. It's about extending lives. It's about life expectancy, I suppose. Because one thing's for sure, I don't know who said it, was it Benjamin Franklin? I think he said it, death and taxes were the only two certain things. So it's really about not so much life or not life, it's about length of life and quality of life. So yeah, really interesting questions.
Well, one of the things you're partly talking about here is how you engage with communities. And that's something you do mention as a third step in the editorial. You talk about finding a way to effectively communicate cost-benefit balance policy decisions to the public. Yeah. And I'm wondering, is it possible to have an effective public health communication strategy during a pandemic, you know, which presents these costs and benefits without overcomplicating the message?
I honestly don't know the answer to that question. And it may not even be with the public. I think when a scientific debate is shut down, I think every scientist should feel affronted by that, you know, and when scientists are attacked because they're proposing alternative points of view, that is really shameful for science. And that has happened. I hate to say it, but I think it's important to say, and I won't obviously, and people will know, you know, the examples I'm talking about, don't need to say them specifically. But I think that happened because of the fear that opening up debate, even within the scientific community, would undermine confidence and even having that discussion. So I don't know what the answer is, but it does suggest to me that scientific integrity can fall victim to these emergencies. I guess the same thing happened in the war, exactly the same thing. So it was like a war footing in a way.
Yes.
Maybe I'm being innocent and naive, a bit romantic about science. And maybe I just need to become more realistic. But certainly I felt affronted by some of the actions and some of the language and the ad hominem attacks on people's reputations and so forth, which I thought were really, really unfair and unfortunate. And I thought we are better than that as a community of scientists. People, I know that's a controversial thing to say, but I really felt that.
Did that shutting down happen within the realm of child and adolescent mental health?
I don't know. I don't think it shut. I don't think there was any shaming going on, to be absolutely honest. But I think it was just implicit. Like I say, it's an emperor's new clothes. Everybody kind of knows that you do a cost-benefit analysis and there are costs. And of course, psychiatrists, psychologists, child psychologists know enough to expect negative impacts of this extraordinary intervention that happened. Again, I'm not making any judgments about whether it should or it shouldn't have happened. I'm really talking about how we can better make those decisions as a group. It's a funny thing, isn't it? It's like self-censorship. I might be getting onto hot ground here, but it's almost like a self-censorship by a community that feels that they don't want to break the magic of the message. I've always been the one to say the quiet bit out loud, unfortunately. So maybe that's what I'm doing. I don't know.
Somebody has to.
We should be thinking about these things. We should be talking about these things, and because they're so important, particularly if this is going to recur and we have to make these difficult decisions. So I honestly don't know. So that's within the scientific community. What about public messaging? That really comes down to trust and education. So perhaps we need, alongside this discussion, this deep and serious discussion about mortality, morbidity, mental health and values, we also need a discussion about science. You know, what is it? Mm-hmm. People like to kind of fall back on a very unscientific concept of facts. A fact isn't really a scientific concept, but there were scientists using the, you know, really getting very close to talking about facts, because they feel that that messaging is something people can grasp. But maybe we need to engage much more in a dialogue about what science actually is, what evidence actually is, and the limitations of evidence, and the issues of really about, I suppose, probability and risk. Now, is that possible? I honestly don't know, but I think we should at least try. Mm-hmm. And I think in a technical democracy, it's actually essential that somehow the public in general are let into the secret around what actually is science. You know, when I hear a scientist on the radio saying, I'm certain that this is true, I shiver because, first of all, I think, are they really a scientist if they say that? You know, or I'm almost certain. That really suggests they're not really thinking as a scientist in terms of kind of classical Popperian hypothetico-deductive approaches and hypothesis building and testing and so forth. So I think we need a debate about these things within our own field, because maybe we're not educated enough about them ourselves. Whether it can work, I don't know, but I think we should try, and I think we should try and evaluate whether it can work and maybe what the best ways of doing that are. But at least I think we should be discussing it.
Yeah, very difficult when the public are looking to scientists for reassurance, isn't it?
Yeah, but we're not nursemaids. I think they've taken, I think Professor Witty and Professor Valance have taken on that role as credible sources. And in a way, they've become part of the intervention rather than being separate from that intervention. That's why I think, just a final thing, I think in terms of recommendations, I would say that when there is a government inquiry, it should be absolutely independent of anybody who's been involved in implementing the lockdown intervention. They should give evidence, of course. What we talk about in intervention research is risk of bias. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest risks of bias is having the person who developed the intervention evaluate it. Now, you can see why that might be the case. It's not always possible for somebody else to evaluate it, but in this case, of course, it is. So I think that would be my recommendation going forward, apart from the government funding natural experiments and trying to really provide support for the development of these health economic models. I think that's really crucial.
Do you have a sort of takeaway message then?
Well, I guess the takeaway message is that we should think about lockdown as we think about any other intervention. We should try as far as we possibly can to apply the same standards of evidence. And those standards of evidence require the estimation of the benefits, and they need to be set against the costs. Clearly, there's a way to go in terms of being able to do that. But I think we need to invest in developing instruments and tools so that we can do that for the future.
Brilliant. Edmund, thank you so much. For more details on Professor Edmund Chanute-Clark, please visit the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelled A-C-A-M-H. And don't forget to follow us on iTunes or your preferred streaming platform. Let us know if you enjoyed the podcast with a rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.